This is Femi Kuti, and you are listening to NYC Radio Live.
All right. How are you doing, everybody? You're listening to NYC Radio Live. My name is David Ellenbogen. So glad to have you. I'm excited. I spent the afternoon with T.H. Vukvil Vinayakram and all of his brothers and sons and grandsons, one of the first families in rhythm. That will take some mixing, but I'm excited to share that. And we are broadcasting from New York City. Can you hear New York City behind me? That's Ocean Avenue in Brooklyn. I wanted to quickly put up this podcast. This is Amir El-Safar. I think the world of him. I think he's one of the great musicians of our time, mixing jazz and maqam, specifically Iraqi maqam, which is a super deep, deep, deep tradition. And he's playing this Friday at our favorite location, Pioneer Works, at 8 p.m. with a 17-piece ensemble. So I thought you would want to know about this. Pioneer Works is at 159 Pioneer Street. You'll want to go. So here is me and Amir El-Safar sitting down. But let's first check out a track from his album, Crisis. This is from a conversation we had a year ago in the summer. All right, you'll dig it, and stay tuned. Oh, and you know, this podcast is brought to you by the Wisdom Matrix. I'm sorry, by the Rubin Museum of Art. And their fall series, The Wisdom Matrix, is underway. And they bring us this piece of wisdom from Emily Dickinson. And my own head, I'm not reading this one. I love that she said, humor is like a frog. You can dissect it, but it dies in the process. Indeed, Mrs. Dickinson. All right. Check out Amir El-Safar. Peace.
Maybe we can just get into some of the elements that created you and created the music. So you're born in U.S.?
Born in Chicago,
Born in Chicago. Uh-huh. But your parents are...
My father is from Baghdad, from Iraq, and he was he left when he was around 18 and then was kind of back and forth between England and Iraq and the U.S. and Iraq. But in the late 60s, he settled permanently in the U.S. shortly after marrying my mother. And she's American, born in New York City, has family going back to the 1600s and, you know, what were the colonies early on.
She's like the Mayflower Club.
Almost. I did the research. We're about 10 years behind, so around 1633, I think. Although, you know, the Hutchinson Parkway that goes up to, from here up to Connecticut, and then that's actually named after Anne Hutchinson, who's... not exactly a blood relative, but she was an in-law of my great to the 12th power grandfather who came here from England. Wow. So there's some family connection.
They give you a break on the Easy Pass?
I don't think there's... Are there tolls on the... I don't think there are tolls on the Hutchinson.
On the Hutch? Well, yeah, I guess you're right.
Right. They would, otherwise. I'd show a card, you know, family member.
Oh, well, sir.
Right. I can speed. That's what I, you know. I don't have to obey the 50-mile-an-hour speed limit.
Beautiful. Wow. Okay, so you got this one side that is American, as American comes, and then your father was Iraqi until he was 18, you said. And then, I mean, just listening to your music, somehow along the way for you, you got deep into that, those roots, at least musically. So how'd that come about?
Yeah. Well, I was kind of living... I did have a bicultural upbringing, having the Iraqi sort of family events and stuff, and hearing some of the music and hearing the language, although I didn't speak Arabic growing up, and I didn't have a very strong Islamic upbringing or anything like that. Although I miss where my father came from, but he wasn't a practicing Muslim when I was growing up. So it was kind of all there in the background, but latent or untouched, untapped, I suppose. But it wasn't until my teens and then really my early 20s that I started to get more and more curious about my Iraqi ancestry and wanting to understand it from a musical perspective. I mean, it started with the music and then it kind of became... the language and culture and just sort of understanding kind of myself in a way, but also where, you know, in the sense of where I come from. And so I went to Iraq in 2002. That was about a year, exactly 1 year before the U.S. invasion, the second U.S. invasion. And that was a really sort of life determining period. Those about 6 months I spent in Iraq in 2002. Really kind of brought me in touch with something that was very much a part of me, but I didn't really know it was a part. It didn't feel like I was like learning new things. It felt like I was almost remembering, including the language. You know, I picked up the language very quickly and very naturally, and people were shocked. My father was shocked when I came home and was just speaking to him in Arabic. It wasn't, you know, after a few months, it wasn't sort of a normal... I mean, I was working hard at it, but it never, you know... Especially the Iraqi dialect came very easily. Like when I tried to learn Egyptian Arabic a few years before, it was okay, but the dialect is different enough that it didn't feel familiar. And then the Iraqi dialect was just like, just I was talking and it just felt very natural. I mean, I didn't have a lot of sophisticated vocabulary. I'm not fluent 100%, but I can express myself and conduct, you know, whatever I need to in Arabic. I've done interviews in Arabic, you know, that's fine. I can sing. I never thought I'd be able to sing without an accent. And I had to, like, go in front of different teachers. I put myself through it. I went through in front of all these different teachers. This was after I'd been studying Iraqi music for a while. And it's like, is this cool? Like, does this sound... like, you sound like you were born in Iraq. And I was like, no, you're just being nice, you know? And I go to someone else and they'd say... you know, when did you come over from Iraq? I was like, no, I'm born in Chicago. You don't get it. Like, oh, okay, you know. They say, you speak English very well. Someone once said that to me. Wow, your English is so good. I was like, yeah, thank you.
That's when you made it, yeah.
Exactly.
Wow, so, and what were the settings that you were getting into music out there? You you found teachers, or you found, like, what was going on?
There are a couple of institutes that are designed for teaching Iraqi maqam, or for mm-hmm. teaching Arabic music in general, Arabic and Turkish music. I didn't find them to be particularly effective. I visited, and some of my teachers were professors at these schools as well, the Institute of Fine Arts and the Institute of Melodic Studies. I like the name. It's sort of more poetic than just music school, you know, like right. really specific to the melodies. And it was designed to teach this Iraqi maqam tradition, but in the context of sort of a conservatory model where there's a teacher and a group of students, and then they sort of scripted, you know, 1 hour lessons every week, you know, it's, I don't think the music was being effectively transmitted in that environment. There were some people that learned it very well, but they had to go on their own and seek out teachers. Because really the music traditionally was taught in this very informal context. It was like these coffee houses where the music was performed, and young people would sneak in and hide somewhere because you're not supposed to really... It's almost like going to a bar when you're underage, although there's mm-hmm. no alcohol consumption, but it's that sense of, you know, this isn't a place for minors. So people would sneak in, hide under a bench somewhere behind a curtain, and listen to these 7.5 hour concerts of various singers, and, you know, kind of do it for a period of time and choose their master, choose who they wanted to emulate. And then there'd be this sort of day, like make it or break it kind of moment, where they would perform in front of their teacher, and the teacher would either accept or reject them as a student. And that rejection might be a lifelong life sentence, like, you're never going to sing in this town again, kid. Or it might be you need to work a little more and try coming back in a year or two. You know, sort of, it was a very intense musical environment. And the way, this is, I'm talking about 100 years ago, even mm-hmm. even up until the 1920s and 30s. That's kind of how the music was imparted. Then there was this model in the late 60s, 70s, 80s that was a sort of conservatory model. It wasn't working very well, in my opinion. I found something in between. I would go to private teachers. I found one teacher who I became very close with, who was actually living in England at the time. This was end of 02, early 03 when I left Iraq, because it was unsafe to stay. But I had this very intense connection with the maqam singer, like the one person alive who knows all this music, which is a little scary. But I would go to him kind of every day and take these several hours long lessons with him, and get not only working on the music, but hanging out, having a meal, taking walks. You know, there was sort of an right. apprentice mm-hmm. type of relationship. And I was really lucky to find that with him. And it just sort of, that really solidified and kind of put things into place for me with the music.
Wow. And I guess, you know, some people, including myself, I mean, I have a sense of, I always thought that maqams are basically the equivalent of a raga, you know, a scale that is very specific and gives a particular feeling. But then I'm looking at your liner notes here, and it says that there is a maqam called something like Mukhalif, said to be the gasping sigh of the survivors after the fall of Baghdad in 1258. So is that usual to have be so specific with the maqams, that they're that?
Well, you touch on a really good point, and it's a very good question, because in Iraq, maqam is a little bit more specific than sort of the general Arab Turkish sense, where the sort of what you said, like it's a scale, maybe it's a little bit more than a scale. I mean, even the raga, it's like, you know, it's a mode which has certain type of phrasing and expected mm-hmm. things and surprise and etc. In Egypt or in Syria or in even Moroccan music and like the classical traditions, and then in Turkish music especially, when you say like maqam sabah or siga or rust, all these maqams, they are more or less a mode with sort of characteristic phrasing, and then you can just you can do an improvisation in a maqam, or you can write a various types of forms. It'd almost be like saying symphony in C major. You'd say like semi in maqam ras, you know, mm-hmm. or longa, which is another form, in maqam bayati, etc., etc. In Iraq, the maqam is actually a composition in the sense that it has a structure, it has a beginning, a middle, and there's varying degrees of flexibility. Some of the maqams are incredibly specific, and some give you choices. You have like a set of choices of when you want. You can go to this melody or that melody. But unlike a sort of normal composition, the way I would think of compositions, they're heavily improvised. So there's a lot of areas in which the singer or instrumentalist is free to do variations and maybe repeat phrases or take little segments of a phrase and explore them, and that's where the innovation comes in. But it's within this set kind of confine of a composition. And it's very it became so stimulating to me as a jazz musician and coming from classical music as well, Western classical music, when I got into the maqams, like this notion of improvisation versus composition, because it's like so specific and yet very, like I'd listen to 10 different recordings and hear 10 wildly different interpretations. So to get back to your question about maqam mukhalif, several of the maqams have stories behind them relating to Iraqi history or general regional history and stuff. And that particular maqam has mukhalif is a very kind of heavy, sad, I don't even know, forlorn, or what's a good word? It's just a destitute sort of feeling. And it is said to originate from when Baghdad was sacked in 1258. And that's kind of when the glorious age of this great city ended.
Thank you.
you know, I guess speaking of being Sakti, so you arrived there before the U.S.'s second invasion. What kind of city? What did you see? Was it like what kind of, you know, is it, was it, because I don't even really have a picture, you know, was it like a kind of, did it feel like like the way Western cities do, you know, where people wearing modern dress and they're you know, and business is kind of booming or chugging along? I mean, like what was,
yeah, it's sort of a mix. It was a mix, and it was, I mean, in general, like Arab cities, they have this sort of different strata of society, and there's a certain bourgeois class and people that are very westernized and western educated and sort of maybe learned in, are we okay with that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a certain class of people that, and then there's the more traditional class where people, you know, still wear the galabia or the dishdasha, the sort of long robes, and the women are dressed, not only covered, but wearing this something called the abaya, which is a large sort of cloak. So there's kind of different parts of society. My family in general were sort of, you know, they're middle class. They would wear Western clothes when they go out, and maybe at home they'd just to be more comfortable, wear sort of more traditional garb. But you know, all the amenities and stuff, running water, and I mean, all of that, of course, were in place. But it was a very tricky time because it was 12 years of sanctions that had kind of decimated the economy, and the infrastructure was really barely functional. It was like everything was working. You know, you walk into a department store, let's say, and a quarter of the light bulbs are on. Most of them are empty sockets, and then the shelves are kind of half full and not exact. You know, it's sort of like people just kind of finding a way to survive, you know, and a way to cope. And by that point, I mean, they pretty much were, you know, there was the oil for food program, and people were sort of, they're making do, you know, like they're getting along sort of okay. It wasn't a boom. I mean, they had the memory of the 1980s and 70s when Baghdad was such a rich city. I mean, Iraq was an incredibly rich country. That oil money was really going into services, and, you know, the city was just kind of booming. And they had, at that point, they had everything we had in the States, TVs and VCRs and whatever technology. I mean, there was, the Iraqi dinar was worth $3. It was stronger than the U.S. dollar. And now, and then after 91, it went to 2,000 dinars equals $1. So just completely destroyed. And so people who had these bank accounts with, someone had like 100,000 dinars, it went from being worth $300,000 to being worth what? What's 150? I can't do the math. $50? Yeah. Right.
Wow.
Yeah. But that was normal. I mean, it just happened.
It happened to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Across the board. Yeah. And then there was sanctions. So certain.
And things. Then there was things, sanctions.
Yeah. Well, it was all, yeah. One was related to the other, but yeah. Right. But yeah, people were surviving. They were oppressed and down about it, but they were sort of excited about the U.S. coming to invade, because it was sort of a relief. Like, okay, anything, just, we want to break out of this isolation, you know. Because, I mean, there was no real communication. Satellite TV was illegal. Internet was barely, you know, people didn't really have connection. They were just starving for some kind of, you know, when I remember I'd sit and watch the news, and somebody would come from Europe, like someone supporting the Iraqi cause or whatever, and it would be like an alien landed from another planet. It was something like remarkable. Like, who's this, you know? Like, so I imagine people probably saw me that way too. So
yeah, I was just going to ask. Yeah, people must have been kind of asking you a lot of questions, and like, you know, they're curious.
Yeah, and that's eventually why I kind of had to leave, because it was, people were asking my relatives questions too, like, who's this half Iraqi, half American cousin of yours that's coming to study Arabic and study music? Like, you know, there's a war that's about to start here. What, like, it was very implausible. And music doesn't have a role in society now where people, like, you know, you're going to travel across the world and live in, you know, it just didn't, people don't see music as that.
So people were wondering if you were some kind of spook.
I think that's what, yeah, that was sort of what my cousins implied, and they were getting nervous. And that was the end of 2002, and I pretty much booked my taxi, and I think I left 2 or 3 days after that. And once I knew that it was making them uncomfortable, I was like, okay.
Right.
It's over. And then 2.5 months later is when the first bombs started pummeling the place. So, yeah. I wasn't there for that, though. So.
And intense. Then it's an intense history, and it's an intense... I feel that one of the really amazing things about music is how it takes you all around these places, and it, you know, it brings me and you to this conversation. It brings the listeners to hearing about these things. It brought you to Iraq, you know, and it cuts through. I mean, I was, wow, what an experience. And obviously, I mean, the result of this, it seems to be all over your music, right? I mean,
it's a part of it. Yeah,
it's an album called Crisis. It's got album, you know, track called Fly Over Iraq. And The Great Dictator, which I assume is a reference to the incredible movie.
Well, there's title came certainly from the Chaplin film. But the reference was also, I mean, take your pick, you know, which dictator you want to talk about, but there's sort of, common themes that seem to recur in our history. So, especially the Arab region in the last, you know, sort of the modern Arab state was kind of founded on these strong despotic rule, you know, whether it was Saddam or whether it was like the kind of military rule in Egypt that temporarily suspended, well, never really suspended, but during that, you know, the overthrow of Mubarak. And then I was living in Egypt also when I, shortly before writing this music in 2013, and so I was sort of, you know, seeing this overthrow and this kind of in between, this like the Muslim Brotherhood was happening, you know, was running the show sort of at that time, and people were fed up, and like the same people who just worked so hard to depose a ruler of 35 years were now trying to depose this new president that they weren't happy with. And it's like, well, what's next? And then, okay, well, back to square one. Let's go back to the military rule and just another person, but more or less the same stuff. And then people are sort of happy, seemingly. And you don't really know what that means exactly. And it's tough. I mean, there's a track also, the Great Dictator, and then the next track is called The People. And in neither case am I trying to say, oh, the dictator's bad and the people are right. And, you know, it's never, it's just because the people sometimes want, I don't know, you know, we don't really know what's best for us sometimes. Not that dictators are the solution or their problem in so many ways, but then you look at, like, you know, okay, Iraq was it was a horrible place. Saddam was awful. And, I mean, I have a cousin, my uncle was, executed during Saddam's time and for just speaking his mind and
at home.
Yeah, someone recorded him and report and took Oof. Him. And this was, he was a 4-star army general, you know, retired. And so, I mean, this was the fate of anybody who, it was known, it was common, disappearances, random searches, whatever. I mean, anything could happen, you know, so it was horrible. And yet I was still able to visit Iraq during that time. I was still able to come and go. Now I wouldn't think, I think about it, but I haven't been back.
It's not the time.
It's really still, I mean, so not to say like that was a good situation. There's a bad, I mean, it's like from bad to worse, but the problem set changes, you know. So anyway, but this is but you know, people were sort of, there were some people that maybe naively or blindly were, just wanted this Saddam gone so something else could come, but that something else ended up being worse. Or the people in Egypt, or the people here, or I don't know where, you know, it's sort of, they're open-ended questions, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in the questions than trying to find answers, because, answers can't really be trusted for very long. So.
تريني عينه فكم وكم أطلب رؤيا وكم سألت بينه يا يابا يا يابا يا عيوني وكم سألت بينه
the politics thing, because it's deceptively pulls you in, and then you're sort of, there's no conclusions to draw. but that's kind of where the music, it's sort of, it enters at that point, where this, you sort of not exactly throw your hands up in the air, it's almost, it's, there's a dynamic and there's a tension and there's something that's in some sort of equilibrium, but it's always off a little bit. I mean, I think life is like that a little bit. And so music kind of like, that's always the point when I start singing or pick up my instrument. It's, and it sounds trite in a way, but it's really the only way to kind of process or relate or deal with. I mean, like when I had left Iraq and I was, felt like I was torn away from my mother or something, you know, and I had to leave just before the invasion. I was like, I don't, you know, I felt like I finally found something that felt, it was home, you know. I don't know how long I would have stayed, but I was definitely not ready to leave. And then for the next, you know, several years and up until now, just seeing the situation get where it sort of is painful. And that just like, but when I could go into the maqam, I felt like I could reconnect and retouch on something that was so deeply rooted and so much, so deeply a part of myself. And so again, these melodies sort of, they carry with them some kind of cultural memory or ancestral memory or some connection to a past that's very, still very vibrant and strong. I mean, they're not really called melodies, they're called like spiritual essences. I mean, that's the technical term in the music, ruhiya, which is not just like melody of this, it's not a clinical description, it's a very, you know, you're singing in the spirit. They just use it. No one goes into it and gets to, they don't talk about it that much, but it's like, those are the words you use. Spiritual essence of Rast or Beat or Siga, you know. So you're sort of, it's a kind of state that, and I find something similar with jazz and with the blues, and, you know, it's described differently. Obviously the syntax is different, but again, it puts you in touch with something that's very, reaches to the core of ourselves individually and then allows for a collective kind of relating or connecting, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the deeper you go inward, the more you can expand or more you can connect. I don't know how to say it, but we sort of find a common source or something.
Well, it certainly transcends like all this, or a lot, at least constructs, right? You know, mm-hmm. like, oh, I'm this, you're that. You know, it's this immediate, incredible, you know, connection. And like you're saying, when you're time traveling, if you're playing a macabre from 1250 mm-hmm. and you're bringing it to life, like that's it's pretty, that's something.
I just got chills when you said that. It's true though, it really does. And I felt like I've visited part, you know, just learning a piece from different parts of the world. I mean, it's not the same as, but you really get in touch with, because it kind of, it's not just an intellectual understanding. There is the intellectual component. You have to, your brain has to work really hard to memorize these things and learn the exact. But it also, there's this other element, especially with the maqam, because the tunings are so specific and they're not really equal tempered. They're very particularly tuned notes in the scale, and they kind of resonate physically in a way that feels very that's why I started singing, because I wanted that sensation of the sound kind of in my bones, in my cells, in my part of that physical connection to it, which then can kind of lead you to spiritual places as well. So it kind of all connects in that way, whereas, you know, reading philosophy, I love reading philosophy, but I just sort of, my mind gets very stimulated, and maybe it can change something, but it's not this. It doesn't go directly the same way sound does.
Right. Yeah. I'm looking at this book. I have the same one.
Oh, Healing Sounds by John Golden. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's very powerful stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of touches on the same kind of concept, which is interesting. That, you know, that we've been kind of bringing up back and forth, that there's this set of notes that's been kind of rammed down our throats by, you know, a kind of music industrial complex that needs to come out with you know, instruments that can change keys, right. but we, if you're just in that mode, you're missing a lot of emotions and a lot of, who knows, maybe a lot of ancestors, maybe, you know, a lot of things are tucked away.
I mean, some extraordinary work has been done within the equal tempered system, right. But yeah, there's something. Once you start exploring and finding other tonalities, then there was a period where I couldn't listen. It's still hard for me to listen to piano music sometimes, because it just, every note sounds out of tune. At some point, I'm like, that's not a good third. The fifth is out. You know, it's like, unless it's real. You know, it depends. But I've had that. I had that experience for a while. Because every note was just a little bit off from where, you know, sort of a reminder of what it is, but it's not the actual,
right?
You know, the real thing sometimes. So.
I think Lamont Young said that's why Western music speeded up, you know, because you have to keep moving, you know, as opposed to a beautiful, perfect, you know, just intonation major 30 could stay there forever.
You just, it feels so good, you don't want to move, and then when you move, it better be something really good that, you know, that's attracting you. And it's so interesting too, because like the tuning, like Iraqi tuning is different from Syrian tuning, and it's different from Egyptian. Every region kind of has its own, or every city, or every, even within a tradition, sometimes different pieces will be tuned differently. And it really makes a difference. Like the melody is kind of dictated by how sharp or flat these microtones are. You know, mm-hmm. you can say C, D, E half flat, F. Where is that E half flat exactly? And you move it a little bit and it works with one melody. You know, there's a certain dynamic, a certain tension created between those sounds. And then that really leads, and it also relates to how you vocalize and how the pronunciation of the vowels takes place, because like an ah or an eh or an eh or eh, you know, they're sort of different, and they really don't sound right with certain intonation. It's so strange, and I don't know if it could be categorized scientifically, but intuitively and on a feeling level, it's very specific in that regard.
So it must be tricky for you to find the right players, you know, in the jazz context to work with, who are kind of sensitive to this. And, you know, that's something that I think is your contribution, and I think it's something that I hear happening now really for the first time, because when I listen to these fusions from like 20 years ago, they just have a Western pianist playing along with, you know, there's a distinctive with you know, oud or something like that, and there's a distinctive, to me, like crappiness of like those two instruments clashing that I'm like, oh, okay, that's like, but you know, there's a new generation of musicians who are like really sensitive to this and are finding a way, you know.
Yeah, it was kind of a given, I think, like in the early fusions, that like, well, of course we're gonna all play in the equal temper because that's kind of the common language, everyone can sort of go there, but it never, I feel like so much was lost in it, and it's like, well, why is this tradition caving to that, you know, why, you know, there's probably some cultural baggage associated with those decisions too, but you know, it's everything's in flux right now. I mean, things are always in flux, but right now I think there's room for even more in this direction, so I hope that I'm part of a larger movement of musicians. That seems to be the case.
That's Amir El-Safar, the new album Crisis. Many thanks to him for sitting down with me, and thanks to you for listening. If you are in the New York area and you've been enjoying this music, I want to let you know about a couple shows I'm producing this month of August 2015. On the 12th, Wednesday the 12th, it will be Brooklyn Raga Massive, an evening with Brooklyn Raga Massive. And that will have Dan Weiss and Samir Gupta doing a tabla duel. And then some of your favorites, if you listen to this podcast a lot, Max ZT, Arun Ramamurthy, Jay Gandhi, and Aaron Hansen playing together. Then, the 14th, I'll be DJing, also at the Ruben Museum. And then on the 28th, and the DJ, by the way, they open, those nights they open up the museum, which is a beautiful Himalayan art museum. Kind of a definitive one around here. It's free admission, so you can check out these mandalas and cool shamanic artifacts and all kinds of stuff. And then the 28th, August 28th, Brooklyn Raga Massive will be playing in C. And we'll be recording it for Northern Spy Records. And that will be also at the Ruben Museum, which is in Chelsea. You can find it. And yeah, I'm sure there's more things to plug, but we got an Africa India concert this Wednesday at Bluebird. Tom Chess, who you've heard or look for him on this podcast, great oud and ney player. That's this Wednesday at Bluebird. Anyway, let's hear one more from Amir El-Safar. Thanks to him for making such beautiful music. Peace and love.
Thank you.
العين به يا فلا قوة